On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
I have such an interesting guest on the bookshelf today. I'm very excited to welcome Dr. Janet R. Jacobson, who is the Claire Toe Professor of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Barnard College, Columbia University, where she has also served as Director of the Center of Research on Women and Dean for Faculty Diversity and Development. Her newest book is The Sex Obsession, Perversity and Possibility in American Politics, and it's from New York University Press, their website, nyupress.org. Dr. Jacobson, thank you very much for joining us today on the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about the convoluted situation we have in America, and do we often think that we have to separate everything out so that we can put everything in a box on one side and a different box in the middle and another box on another side in order to get along, or do most people realize that life is complicated and that means that there are going to be some places where we don't agree on things?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question and a very interesting thing to start. And I think many people's experiences are actually somewhat bifurcated on this, which is in their own lives, people often realize how complicated life is. They have commitments and relationships with all different kinds of people, and they have to, you know, care for small children or for their parents or for their aunts and uncles, or in my case, I, you know, care for a disabled partner. There's all kinds of complications that people can see on the ground. But when we move to our politics, a lot of that complexity tends to go away. And we do tend to act more in terms of boxes, you know, red states, blue states, left, right, single issues we focus on, you know, as Bill Clinton did in 1992, it's the economy, stupid, even though I argue that he was thinking about a lot more than just the economy. And so when we move from life as it is on the ground to politics, we actually lose a lot of what we need in order to make life go well. And that's why I actually, by the end of the book, I start arguing for justice from the ground up, for the idea that we should start with the way people live and try to build our politics from there.
One of the things that I found very interesting in your book, and I agree with this completely, that the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century initiated a sexual revolution of its own. That is to say, prior to that, there were very limited choices that people had, and certainly for most of humanity's history, women have had fewer choices than men about who they would marry, but also about what they would do, whereas the Protestant Reformation said, reiterated what Paul wrote 1,600 years earlier, that in God's eyes, women and men are equally valid. There is no difference between slave and free, Greek and Jew, male and female, that they're all equally valid. Now, to be honest, the church has not always lived up to that lofty standard, but that is the goal before us. So the Protestant Reformation had more of an influence on American thinking than we usually give it credit for, and I found that very interesting that you brought that point up.
Yes, and I think the other point that you make, which is what's the relationship between what we aspire to and how we live, especially given the topic of my book and our political lives. So one of the things I think about is precisely that appeal to a certain universal equality that you find in, Protestant Christian traditions. You actually find it in many religions across the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that appeal to a universal ethic, one of the questions I ask at the end of the book is, what does it really mean to try to make the world universally accessible, universally equal? And how would we have to change our political lives in order to live up to that ideal more than we do at the current time?
One of the things that has been a very complicated situation between left and right, if you will, on a political stance that has to do with sex and religion is about abortion. And I think even the words that we use reflect how our feeling is about it. Reproductive health issues versus abortion, pro-choice versus pro-life. Even the phrases that we use are signals to the way we feel about the situation. You referenced President Clinton earlier. He was the one that said, we'd like to see abortion safe, rare, and legal. I would contend that that's another goal that has not yet been met, because there are people like Kermit Gosnell that are out there. But is there a place where people can meet on that, or is this one of those things that we have to try to divorce from politics, or what?
Yeah, I think there are places that people can meet, and even if they don't meet fully, where there can be overlaps. I have a colleague at New York University who's an anthropologist named Faye Ginsburg, who did a study of in a town in I think it was South Dakota with an abortion provider in the 1980s, and she interviewed people on all sides of the issue and what it meant in a relatively a rural area to have these services available in this town, and how did people feel about it. And what she found was one of the major points of agreement is that whether people were, in the terms they used at that time, were pro-choice and pro-life, whatever they side they fell on that spectrum, they tended to believe that motherhood was devalued in the United States. And what they meant by that was, for people who were pro-choice, they felt that it's difficult to have a child in the United States, and it shouldn't be. And one of the things that we do in the, you know, safe, rare, and legal, where it's not as rare as it should be, is precisely because people face really difficult questions about can they support a child, about are they in relationships that where it would be safe to raise a child, are, you know, what are the situation, what's the situation in which they're bringing a child into, and that's simply devalued, that once the child is born, that just goes away. On the other side, for those who were pro-life, what they felt was that motherhood was not taken as seriously as it should be. And as a result, anything that seemed to make it seem as though it was something that could be easily taken up or let go of further devalued it. So one of the places where people can come together, and one of the things, again, that I advocate in the conclusion of the book is the idea that we should take caring for each other much more seriously than we do. Mm. And that's in all kinds of ways, including caring for small children, including caring beyond the bounds of any single, you know, nuclear family. Just how do we set up a society in which it is easier for people to care for each other, and therefore it would make it easier to bring children into the world for those who want to. And at the same time, is it the case, and I would argue that it is, sometimes most caring not for people not to have to bear a child when they find themselves to be pregnant for all kinds of reasons, including that their health may be in danger, but also that this is not the right time in their lives to bring a child into the world.
We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Dr. Janet Jacobson, the author of The Sex Obsession, Perversity and Possibility in American Politics, from New York University Press. One of the issues that you referenced in the book is this ongoing tug of war between personal rights and between religious freedom. And if I can, I would like to explain the best I can why certain people feel the way they do about the cake situation, which ended up being a Supreme Court decision and all of that. And I would say that many Christians that I know agreed with the baker for the thought that, well, you know, if I go to a place where I feel like they don't want my business, I don't go back there. If it's the only place in a small town, it's more complicated. But if you're in a good-sized place, hey, I've been to cleaners that I didn't like. I've been to restaurants that I didn't think were clean. And if I don't like the looks of them, or if they don't treat me well, I just don't ever go back there. I don't generally think of that as being a religious decision. I just say, I don't want to do business with them, so I don't do business with them. It kind of seems like that the lawsuit references back really to the Civil Rights Act, perhaps. And I remember Senator Everett Dirksen, certainly not a bigot, was concerned about that act because he said one of the things that it did was keep people from having the autonomy to decide who they wanted to rent to. And he said, I understand what we're trying to accomplish here, but I'm thinking that at some point in the future, someone is going to twist this around. And I'm wondering, are those ideas connected to each other, or am I just running down a rabbit trail?
No. I mean, I think one of the things that, again, I think about in the book, and there's a chapter on Supreme Court cases, is in part because they do, in fact, work in relation to each other, particularly around race and gender and sexuality, and also issues about how we think about class, for example, in relation to university admissions. But part of the issue is this. What does it mean to have a set of religious commitments that have to do with either how you gather together in a particular religious community or in an organization that is not part of the public market? But the specific questions about personal rights in relation to the public market, meaning what happens when you enter into the market and do an exchange, a commercial exchange, have a long history. And that history, unfortunately, is one in which religion has been invoked in order to further discrimination. This is certainly true around a whole history of cases about race and racism, and then we have seen a series of cases that are somewhat similar and that get invoked in relation to each other around the question of gender and sexuality. And one of the things that happens around religious freedom cases is that there are several sort of confusions that come into it, one of which is that the public market is a specific thing. It is not everything. It doesn't say everything you can say about what your political views are. It is not a moment in which, the ways in which you can gather and your rights to assembly are at issue. It has to do specifically with commerce. And that can get lost. And the other thing is, what does religious freedom really mean around who is the subject of religious freedom? So in my reading of the Constitution, everyone, every citizen, everyone in the United States is the subject of religious freedom. It is not just people with religious identities.
Right.
And that means that you can't say, well, my religious commitment is X, Y, and Z, and thus you must abide by my religious commitment, whether or not you have one. And the point at which that right, to say this is my religious commitment stops, I would argue, is commercial transaction.
Yeah, it's a very complicated thing, though, isn't it? Because you or I should say, maybe it's a delicate balance thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
To use a not very good analogy, it's like the old saw about your right to swing your hand stops at the point where it connects with my nose. And I guess that's why the Supreme Court is as good a place as any to try to hash these details out. When does something become a step over into the field of are we restricting commerce? Or when does something step into the field of, no, that really is a religious expression, and that's protected by the First Amendment? The thing about religious freedom is that means that everybody has the right to have no religion whatsoever, and it also means the right that anybody can worship any way they want to. The main thing is it prevents the government from dictating the terms,
right.
which was a reaction to the way things were in Europe and the way things were originally in the colonies, because most of the colonies tended to be one denomination or another, all Christian, but different denominations. Maryland was Catholic and Pennsylvania was Puritan and so forth, and Virginia was Anglican, and therefore the way to get out of those thorny issues about, well, if you can't vote in this state because you're a Catholic, or you can't vote in this state because you're not a Catholic, is nobody gets to make those decisions. It's up to, everybody gets to make those decisions. The government does not.
Right. Yeah. One of the things that's very, very important about that can get lost is the sense in which saying the government doesn't get to decide about certain types of things can be protective of religious expression specifically. And this is one of the things that where arguments over same-sex marriage also got kind of confounded, which is the idea that the government should enforce one version of marriage because that was many people's religious commitment, meant that if the government changed, then religious people and religious organizations were in a different position vis-a-vis marriage. And what I argued at the time before 2015 was, no, the government should not be sanctifying marriage in one way or another. There, contracts, state-based contract is one thing, but a minister of any church should not be saying, by the power vested in me by the state of whatever state it is, I now pronounce you, because that precisely entangles religion and the state in ways that not only are problematic for people who don't share whatever that pastor's religious beliefs are, but that puts the pastor at risk from state interference.
Right. When everything happened about Oberfeld, and people were talking to me, and I was a Methodist pastor still at the time, and they said, well, what is this going to mean for you? And I said, well, I'm not sure, but I do know where this all started. And I said, it started the day that we allowed the government to charge us to get married.
Right.
When that happened, that was the seed of all of this, because if you're asking the government's permission to get married and paying them money for the privilege, then someday they're going to change the rules, and if you don't like it, you're out of luck. I said, if it had just stayed a religious thing in the church, and it would have always been called a civil union if the states wanted to make money off it, which of course they would, then this would not be as, I don't think, would have been as big a disruptive thing as it seemed to be in the Christian community. And of course, there is the same kind of problem that we have with the church, that with homosexuality, as it has been with race relations, that far too often there it's been very short on compassion and love, and very long on setting rules and regulations, being very Pharisaical more than Christ-like.
Yeah, and it is also the case that some religious traditions, including Christian traditions, you know, before Obergefell, the UCC, and other religious Christian denominations, were marrying same-sex couples, and yet they couldn't do the same thing vis-a-vis the state that they could do for heterosexual couples. And so in one way, their religious freedom was abridged by not being able to have the marriage services that their tradition allowed for. And so that sense, part of what the book is trying to do is say, we can open some of these questions up in ways that might actually make things less, as you say, disruptive for those who have strong religious commitments one way or another, whether those are toward, certain forms of openness vis-a-vis gender and sexuality, or whether those are for more of a conservatism. But part of what we want to do is make it so that we don't get so entangled with the power of the state around these questions.
I will say that as a survivor of the 60s and 70s, that I have seen the damage that promiscuity did to lots and lots of people. Free love often, even though it seemed like a great idea at the time, did a lot more psychic damage to women, because they tend to be more compassionate and more connected. Men can be dispassionate, which is one of the things that makes us not so fun to be around sometimes. I've just seen so many people that I was in school with years ago that suffered in one way or the other because of decisions that they made when they were young, and I hate to see people doing that. And my feeling about why I encourage people to get married, say, and so forth, is that I've seen what can happen when people cohabitate. It usually doesn't work out well for the women. More women go into poverty when they are basically cut adrift from a stable relationship. So that's one reason that I'm conservative on social issues, is that I've seen what can happen, and I don't want it to happen to another generation.
Yeah, and one of the questions that the book asks is, what does make women vulnerable, for example, in a marriage that they are cut adrift from, or that they want to leave because, for example, it might be variously abusive or damaging to them? Mm-hmm. And why are women vulnerable after something like that happens? You know, where do these vulnerabilities come in? And is it simply the result of gender and sexuality and sexual relations, or is it the case that we could do more in our society? And this sort of goes back to the breadth of what it might mean to be pro-life, about can we do more as our society to address some of those vulnerabilities so that people don't find themselves in situations, whether it is in a sexual situation where they're not married to the person and they really wish they could get out, but, you know, there are various entanglements, or whether it's in a marriage that is one that is simply not good for them. We could do more to help people than we do as a society right now. And again, I think that's one of the places where people might be able to come together more, where if we weren't focused on making sexual judgments, we could look at vulnerabilities and look at what it means for us to care in our communities.
Yeah, and about scoring political points on each other, too.
Yeah, also true.
I remember when we were talking about abortion a couple of minutes ago, I was trying to remember who it was. I remember when Senator Ted Kennedy was still alive and was still a lion of liberalism in the U.S. Senate, that there was a bill that was put forth by a conservative Republican senator who was, I think, an OBGYN in his regular life, and it concerned a situation that was developing that the prenatal test were allowing people to discover if they had, if they were going to have children who had Down syndrome. And if they discovered that they were going to have a child with Down syndrome, a startlingly high percentage of them would have an abortion. This conservative was very concerned about that, but he knew he couldn't get any traction on it unless he talked to Ted Kennedy. And Ted Kennedy, amazingly enough, kind of went in with him on that and co-sponsored a bill to try to limit that. And the reason was that Ted Kennedy had a personal interest in that because he had a sister who had who was retarded, as they said in those days, and mentally challenged. And he understood that the people who are mentally challenged are not less human just because they aren't like people who don't have those challenges. And I think that kind of reaching across the aisle could happen more often, I think, if we looked at situations like you're saying. How do we work together and make things better for women who find themselves in abusive relationships and leave, and let's keep them from automatically going into poverty? Or how do we work in a community for people who are victims of injustice, of all kinds of things? What can we do across the aisle with each other that we can accomplish good things? We don't have to agree on everything. I don't agree on everything with every Christian. We don't have to. We can disagree about some things, even important things, if we have some common places that we can meet. And I think that's what your book is talking about.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, disability is a great example. I've spent a lot of time in the disability activist community because my partner lives with a spinal cord injury, and you know, I talk about that some in the conclusion to the book. And you know, one of the things that, again, we're very bad at is caring for people with disabilities and creating a public world that is according to principles of what disability activists call universal design or universal access. So there are sort of three different problems around a disability, at least. One is the one that you mentioned, which is there is still all kinds of prejudice, just straight-out prejudice against people with disabilities, where, you know, there's just open bias. Or I admit I was watching a James Bond movie the other night, and, you know, the villains are almost always disabled in some way. That's how you know they're bad, right? There's that connection between moral badness and disability. So that's just flat-out prejudice. Then there's the question of care. You know, so if you have a disabled child, how are you going to care for this child? What happens if, you know, you're a single parent and you're working, or even if both parents are working? How do we care for people with disabilities? And then the third thing is the public world, that we have created a world where there are all kinds of barriers, from the steps to go from one building to another to, you know, the ability to have the type of transportation that would allow people to move around, or not having streetlights that allow people who are blind to hear the streetlights. You know, there are all kinds of ways in which we could make the world better so that disabled people were more in the world, and in the public world, and that would go part way. It wouldn't do everything toward addressing some of these problems of just direct prejudice.
Yeah, but this was a place in the book I also found very interesting. You talked about the benefit, say, of redesigning the curbs, as a lot of cities, even our little town, which is a small city, has done this, is redesign the curb so that you can roll off instead of having to drop down to get off the curb and get into the street to cross the street. Such a simple thing of smoothing it out so that people can roll there not only helps people who are greatly disabled, who are in wheelchairs or something, but it will also eventually help people who are able now, but 10 years from now, after having had a catastrophic event like happened to your partner, they can no longer get along without a walker or something. Or it's just easier to step into the street, and the older we get, the more that we think, I don't want to have to take a big leap down there, because what can happen? I think that's a perfect example of this seemed like it was a nice thing to do for people who were disabled, and there were people that complained about it and said, it's a lot of money and everything, but now we're finding, well, gee, it's kind of nice to have a ramp for everybody, isn't it? And it's kind of nice to have this cutout place in a curb. And all those people that in 1990 grumbled and grumped about it are now maybe hopefully starting to see this is a really good idea. And it's really good to care about how people are able to get around, and it's just smart.
Yeah, and that's the thing that could be spread, you know, more broadly, that what you find is that all kinds of things that make the world better for disabled people or for other people who have been marginalized by the way our public world is organized, stopping those barriers, bringing them more into public life, creating access, in fact, makes it better for most people, you know, so that having ramps that go up into buildings make it better for women with strollers who are caring for children,
right,
or men with strollers. I mean, anyone who's trying to move a small child through the world, this is you know, a complex task, just as it can be complex to move through the world when you're disabled. Similarly, having closed captioning, I watch often television with closed captioning on. It just makes it easier to follow and sometimes more interesting. These are all things that were associated with the needs of disabled people that actually make the world better for most, if not all, people. And it's that sense of being able to look toward the marginalized in society, and again, to think about specifically Christian, although again, many religious traditions have that, imperatives where a turn toward thinking about the marginalized, thinking about the poor, you know, these are issues that are often part of religious traditions, and that turn we sometimes wall off into something called charity or something like that. And what I'm arguing is, no, that could be the basis of our public life, being able to think about those most in need.
Janet, thank you so much for writing the book and for making time to talk to us today. I think that there's an awful lot in here that will make people think in new ways and think about possible alliances and possible cooperative ventures, and not try to be so one way or the other. I know people, and I realize that people tend to look at the time that they're living in and think it's very much one way or the other. And I hear people talking all the time on both sides of the fence, oh, we're so partisan today, oh, we're so partisan today. And I'm a casual student of American history, and I can say that we have been much more divided than we are now, and we have been just as partisan as we are now all along. We tend to fantasize about how wonderful it must have been 50 years ago or something. Well, there's not a president that ever served that didn't have people that disagreed with him and felt they were in the right and he was not. I think it's time for a good people of goodwill from whatever place we began, that we can meet in the middle and work for the betterment of people, especially those that have been marginalized and disenfranchised.
I couldn't agree more, and I really appreciate you having me on the program.
Once again, our guest today, Dr. Janet Jacobson, the author of The Sex Obsession, Perversity and Possibility in American Politics. It's from New York University Press. Their website is nyupress.org. Janet, do you have a website people can go to also?
I do. It's Janet Jacobson, all one word, .org, but I'll spell my name for you. It's JanetJacobson.org.
Thank you again for joining us and giving us the opportunity to have dialogue here.
Thanks so much.
Our thanks once again to Dr. Janet Jacobson, who is the Claire Toe Professor of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Barnard College, Columbia University, where she also serves as Director of the Center for Research on Women and Dean for Faculty Diversity and Development. Her latest book, The Sex Obsession, Perversity and Possibility in American Politics, from New York University Press. Once again, her website is Janet Jacobson, all one word, and spelled, again, JAKOBSEN.com. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and podcast. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.